Hello and welcome to the Bergkamp Wonderland podcast. This is Rad speaking, a rare appearance by me at the helm. And tonight we have a very special book review with our special guest, Alex Finn. And we'll be talking about his extra chapters that he's written in his book, Arsenal, The Making of a Modern Superclub. Before we get to him, I have to introduce our hairy producer, Danny the GFP, who this week has been announced as the chief Ewok in the next Star Wars film. You must be very proud, Danny.
Yeah, because I don't like Star Wars. That's not too bad. I'm very hairy at the moment.
Are you looking forward to this one tonight?
I certainly am. Yeah, Alex is a fascinating author, and I've loved his book, and I'm glad
excellent
that he's
brought
stuff out some more chapters. Good.
Excellent. And with Danny tonight, and someone to balance out the arguments, is our whiskey connoisseur, Dave, also known as the Goonaholic. Dave, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Raj. I like the bit about balancing the arguments out. Sure, we're not going to have any.
No, it'll be fun tonight. And absolutely, I must go on to our guest of honour tonight. Alex has actually been on this podcast before. He was on here about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, when we did the first review of the book. His book was so good, and these extra chapters are so interesting. We thought we'd get him back on, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes. But Alex, if you didn't know who he was, he is the author of Arsenal, The Making of a Modern Superclub, which we are going to review tonight. Also, Arsene and Arsenal. And his career, he was a director at Saatchi & Saatchi Advertising for nearly 20 years, handling some of the biggest advertisers in the UK, as well as clients in sports such as Tottenham Hotspur, boo, and the Football League. As a result of his many sporting experiences, he is acknowledged as one of the architects of the Premier League and the Champions League, and is recognised as one of the leading gurus of football. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. What a build-up. I can't possibly live up to all of that.
I've been rehearsing it all day. Was it good?
Very good.
Excellent stuff. Alex, we're going to go straight in. The first question is a simple one. Why did you think you needed to add some extra chapters? I know there's a lot been going on over the last 12 months with marketing, sponsorship, the amount of money coming in. Was that a reason why you felt the need to update the book?
Yes, but also the fact that, much to my surprise, the book was successful and was reprinted about 8 times, so much so that it's went out of print, and the choice was either reprinting the old edition, which finished in 2011, or, because so much has happened, as you've just said, bringing it up to date. And along with my co-author Kevin Witcher, we took the latter course. So we've added 4 new chapters and a postscript, which takes the story right up to the end of the transfer window in September 2016. Two of the chapters are really just retelling the story that all Arsenal fans will know, the missing seasons from 2011. But there are two others that are perhaps more important, one that deals with marketing and finance, and one that actually has, courtesy of David Dean and also my past relationship with Arsene Wenger, perhaps some insights that people might find interesting on the way that the club is run now and possible future developments.
You talk about Arsenal and many clubs now as a brand more than a football club. And I know exactly what you mean with the kind of money that's coming into the club, into all of these clubs, actually, and not just the big four. How do you think the brand will develop at Arsenal over the next few years?
Well, people get very upset when you talk about a football club as being a brand. But they shouldn't, really, if they understood what a brand was. A brand is something that brings emotional and rational values. And the strongest brands are football brands, because the fan is different from the customer. The customer who is loyal can still take his business elsewhere, and does. So customers are promiscuous. Fans are not. And therefore, the Arsenal brand is so strong, and it's only really limited by the number of fans that there are. And of course, there are millions of Arsenal fans across the world now. So they are enjoying the fact that they have a wonderful football club and a strong business. But I would question whether they've made the most of their potential, both on and off the field. In other words, is the brand performing at its optimum? And I would say good, but could do better.
While we're on this topic, the brand is currently suffering a little bit in terms of the way that people look at the things such as seat occupation, which is running at about 90% at the moment. And there is some pressure from supporters organisations on the club to take some action on in that regard. Do you, in your discussions with David Dean, has this come up at all?
You raise a good point, Dave. The fact is that because fans are different from customers, the club can take an attitude which is, well, this is what it's going to cost you. If you don't like it, don't pay it. And there are plenty more waiting outside. Because of the popularity of the Premier League, which is the biggest, the richest, the most successful football league that's ever been seen before, and is only second to the NFL in terms of sports leagues across the world, the fans have much less of a voice than they had hitherto. The club doesn't really listen to the fans, and the fact that the tickets are paid for but not used is of much more importance to the owner than the fact that they will be playing to a half-empty stadium with the tickets not bought. I think the owner will only start to really worry when the stadium is half empty and when the renewals fall at a much faster rate than they are at the moment, because there are plenty of people still prepared to pay. And unfortunately, because it's an entertainment business, because it's a hot ticket in town, there will always be people prepared to stump up. So the actual fan base has changed, and probably changed for the worse, that to people to whom the football club was part of their life, not a day went past without them thinking about the football club. There are many more who think about the football club just as a place of entertainment, which they could take or leave. And some of them are obviously leaving it, and they can afford to leave it, which is a great pity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand that. Thank you very much for that. Raj?
When you were talking about ticket pricing and stuff, there was you said that, you know, there was a lot of intransigence with the clubs. You do highlight two instances last season in your addendum to your book. The first one is the Barcelona game at Arsenal, where Arsenal tried to put a surcharge onto the tickets. The fans reacted very, very badly to it on social media and in the press, and Arsenal in the end decided not to do that. And the second case was at Liverpool, where the fans staged a walkout to protest against the £77 ticket price in the new stand. Do you think that, I mean, these are isolated incidents, and I don't know whether at club level is going to have too much of an effect, but do you think in the future, in order to affect change in ticket pricing, that campaigns need to be made at national level rather than club level?
Yes, I think so. And I think the Football Supporters Association actually achieved a long-standing objective, which was to cap the price of away tickets. And some clubs obviously have more conscience than others. And Arsenal, to their credit, are actually subsidising the travel of away gooners.
Yeah.
And also, you can look at other clubs like Southampton, who are actually dropping prices at home as well as away. So I think fans' organisations, they get themselves together. If they can act on a national basis, then what they can be is really like a terrier. They can snap at the ankles and they can give you a nasty nip, but they can't really cause you any terminal injury. But of course, it's very bad PR if you're trying to actually fleece the fans. And that's what could have happened in one or two cases. And in those instances, clubs are sensible enough to say, well, we've got enough money rolling in, particularly from the television deal. We don't need this bad PR. Fans will create, even if they look at it in this cynical way, that fans are really the extras on a film set, and they provide the verisimilitude, the reality. And we're not going to get the television rights, huge fees, and the hike in the television rights if Arsenal versus Tottenham, for example, is played with three quarters of the stadium only full. So common sense has prevailed in these instances, and let's hope more of it prevails in the future.
I think some of the fans, I think a lot of fans were upset by these two incidents last year, because everyone, even the layman, is kind of knows how much TV money is coming into the game now. And you also mentioned some of the sponsorship deals that Manchester United and Chelsea have, and how Arsenal may be lagging behind a little bit. And that was one of the reasons why they were so annoyed that, you know, with all this money coming in, they were still trying to rip fans off and add £5 here, £6 there. The section that you wrote about sponsorship and marketing, Arsenal do lag behind these other big clubs. What does Arsenal have to do in the future to try and kind of meet the sponsorship levels of the Chelseas and Man Uniteds?
The most successful business arises from the most successful team. To have a successful business, you've got to have a successful team. And a successful team does not mean just finishing fourth and qualifying for the Champions League. It means winning titles, or at least making a good fist at trying to do so. And Arsenal have failed in that in the last few years. It's been many years since they've had the money to spend, but they are still being outspent. You might argue, or they might argue, the people who did the deal for the stadium, that actually inhibited the sort of sponsorship, merchandising, and replica shirt business that they could have done at the time. They are playing catch-up, and it's instructive that every year that goes by, Bayern Munich, who they like to compare themselves with, the board like to compare themselves with, show them a clean pair of heels in the marketing sense. And the way they've done that is to treat the fans as customers and realizing that if you're a customer, you could take your business elsewhere. So they have been more fan-friendly. And on the other hand, you've got a club like Manchester United, who are actually a bigger business and always will be because they are a bigger brand. And I will tell you that I had an argument with Arsene about this, that he said to me about 5 years ago. He said, I'm going to make Arsenal a bigger club than Manchester United. And I said, you can't. He said, but I'm going to. And I said, you can't. You don't understand the history and tradition of United, triumph and tragedy, and the success in the Premier League era is just a much more powerful appeal to fans than the Arsenal business. If you want to make an improvement in the Arsenal business, the only thing you can do is to try and win the Premier League, or failing that, the Champions League. And then you might challenge them, but it will take a number of successive titles before you can even think of overtaking them.
While we're on the subject of good teams, you need good teams on the pitch and off the pitch as well. And there has been a changing relationship, it seems, between Arsene and, let's say, Ivan Gazidis. And what do you know of the relationship between the two of them these days? And also perhaps Dick Law, because we've all seen the bits and pieces that come out in the press every now and again. For example, the Danny Welbeck transfer that was done while Arsene was out of the country, which suggests that Ivan Gazidis has taken a stronger stance in the deal. And of course, then there's been the spending of a great deal of money this summer. How much of that was down to Arsene and how much of that was down to Ivan and to Dick?
Well, let's go back a number of years. And Danny Fisman and Peter Hill-Wood were at dinner with Arsene. And Danny Fisman said, more or less jokingly, you understand, Arsene, what would you do if I gave you £100 million? And Arsene said, I would give it straight back to you. And that was his attitude. He was determined that he was not going to join the race where you have to spend money, because if the sort of transfers that he would be expecting to pay exceeded his valuation, then he wasn't prepared to do it. And the criticism that you can level at the club is that nobody forced him into the realization that in his way of operating, he was possibly harming the actual club that he loves so dearly. And a case in point, of course, is Luis Suarez. People feel that if Arsene had gone back with a bid of 50 million, which he was encouraged to do so by his directors, then Suarez would have been an Arsenal player. And of course, history tells us that because of the way that Suarez worked with Sturridge, that they were both very prolific goal scorers, you wouldn't have lost Giroud's goals. And in that season, the season that we're talking about before the possible Suarez transfer, Giroud scored 16 in 36. You could have kept those, added Suarez at least 30, and Arsenal would have won the Premier League. Why didn't Arsenal do that? Because the directors didn't force Arsene to say, Arsene, don't worry about the money. We'll concern ourselves with the money. If you really want him, pay 50 million. 50 million was never offered. I would like to think that if David Dean had been around, then maybe Dean would have said to his friend, Arsene, I'll deal with the board. I'll deal with the money. You want the man? We'll get him. Because after all, remember that the two of them were responsible for 9 out of the 11 Invincibles. The only people that they didn't buy came through the club, Ray Parlour and Ashley Cole. Everybody else, the two of them secured. Now, if you compare that as the gold standard, Arsenal have fallen a long way below that, haven't they, in recent years?
Yes, I understand that, and to have some sympathy with that viewpoint, which leads on to the obvious next question. You do write in the book about whether there is any possibility of a return for David Dean now that the key protagonists in his previous spell at the club have now moved on. The only thing that I would say to that and would seek a view from you on is the fact that presumably Stan Kroenke will have a view about that in the light of his subsequent selling of his shares to Alish Usmanov, and whether that would be a potential reason for him not returning.
It's a good point you raise, but remember that it was Dean who brought Kroenke to the party in the first place. Hmm. And the second and most important thing is what Arsene wants, Arsene gets. And it's absolutely mystifying to me that the two of them, who are such close friends, that they see each other almost weekly, talk to each other twice a week at least, that David Dean is not back there. Because with Dean back there, more money would be spent. Even if we look at the last transfer window, for example, Arsenal spent 90 million, but Chelsea, Manchester United, Manchester City, all spent well over 100 million. So Arsenal are always lagging behind. They're lagging behind in marketing. They're lagging behind on the playing side. I would like to think that if Arsene had his friend around him, and his friend would be, he's older, he's wiser, and he would challenge Arsene more. In the past, he didn't. Arsene put it, David does my dirty work for me, meaning dealing with agents, dealing with the minutiae of transfers. David loved the wheeling and dealing and was excellent at it. Who's excellent at it now? Dick Law is a very good conduit, and they have pulled off one or two coups, Ozil and Sanchez. But it's not enough. You do not win titles now with just two world-class players in your team. So it's a great pity, and I'm mystified. And when I raised it with David, I said, you know, you and Arsene worked so well together, and David concurred. We were a duo, he said. Why are you not back at Arsenal? Why has Arsene not asked you to come back? And this was his answer, and I quote more or less exactly, the subject has never come up. Well, it could have done, it should have done, and if it had have done, then the two people who were instrumental, along with Ken Fryer, Danny Fisman, and the unsung hero, Anthony Spencer, who found the stadium site for them, they are the architects of the modern Arsenal. But why keep Dean at a distance when he could do so much now with his friend? It's a mystery to me. It's a mystery why Arsene has not insisted. It's a mystery why Dean, whose loyalty is such that, for example, other people who've loved their clubs, and I will name them, like David Bernstein and Irving Scholar, who really started the commercial business at Tottenham, those guys have succumbed to the blandishments of people who said, we miss you in football, please come back. So they've gone to clubs that are not of their own. David Dean would never do that. David Dean is loyal to Arsenal in the same way that he is to his family. David Dean was offered jobs, directorship jobs, at Newcastle, at Everton, at Barcelona, and he would never, ever consider them because his heart remains with Arsenal. Even his nemesis, Peter Hill-Wood, he felt that he should. I've been with David when I've stood outside the director's entrance at Arsenal, and he said, I must go and have a word with Peter. And it was Peter who fired him. And the fact that he wanted to have a word with Peter was that because Peter was the Arsenal chairman, and it was the chairman of his club. And I just think that it's a great shame that someone who, I don't think he was perfect by any means. David's motto was, I would always do what's in Arsenal's best interests. In other words, I would think and do what I think is in Arsenal's best interests, and he would believe that's in the best interests of Arsenal and of football. But it wasn't always the case. Life is on the side of the big battalions, but other ships should be allowed to sail around the world. And in the Arsenal world, in David's world, I'm not sure he paid too much attention to that. But in terms of loving and putting Arsenal before everything else, you couldn't find any other director, apart from maybe his best friend, Bill Kenwright at Everton, who shared the same love and care and attention to their clubs and were prepared to do anything for them.
That's a fascinating insight. Thank you very much indeed for that. Danny, I think you've got a point to make.
Yeah, hello, Alex. Should we be worried about the resurgence of Liverpool? Because for me, Jurgen Klopp is one of the best managers in the Premier League, maybe even the best with the amount of money that he's not been spending. Are you worried that maybe if Wenger did have all the money that he wanted to spend, we could end up doing what Man United are doing, just constantly chucking money at a club and just going from worse to worse?
Well, you make a good point about the quality of the managers. There are different managers now in the Premier League. You mentioned Klopp and Guardiola, and you've got to add Conte to that. And these guys, I think, look at the game in a different way to Arsene Wenger. These guys constantly, I imagine, beat themselves up, asking themselves, what is it that I can do that will give me an edge over the competition? Arsene is more circumspect. Of course he takes defeat very badly. And I can actually tell you of an instance or instances whereby David and Arsene will go to the local restaurant, and the manager, who's actually an Arsenal season ticket holder, will know that if Arsenal have lost, he will automatically cancel the booking. Because from personal experience, when they've been out together, it turns into a monologue. So they're talking and asking Arsene questions, and he is lost in his own world because he's actually lost that afternoon. So he does take things personally. It matters a great deal to him, but I don't think he looks at it in the same way these other managers do, who beat themselves up to find angles, marginal gains, in the way that Arsene won't, because what he will do is, how can I encourage the players to play to their maximum, not how can I get one over the opposition. So the concentration, I think, is on how he can best use his resources. But does he have the best resources? And the answer probably is no, because he hasn't spent the money. And the facts are that the more money you've spent and the higher wages you pay, the more success you have. And Arsenal are lagging behind these clubs that I've just mentioned. They're lagging behind United. Believe me, money will out. It might take them 1 or 2 years, but maybe, and in this case, I might be wrong, that maybe Mourinho has shot his bolt, and it's the law of diminishing returns in United. But that will be a case, a unique case, where money hasn't bought success. But certainly, you've got to be aware of the way that City are run, the way that Liverpool are run, and the way that Chelsea are run. And they are run by coaches who are a very different type to Arsene Wenger.
Alex, do you ever think that Arsene Wenger worries about his how his legacy will be at the club? Because no Arsenal fan will ever go, oh, that Arsene Wenger, he saved us millions of pounds that the owner doesn't have to spend and went back in the owner's pocket. No one is going to think that. Everyone's going to think, oh, all that money that he had that he could have spent on players, he didn't spend it. Is he aware of that point?
Yes, I think so. I think it's a good point to raise, because he is spending money now, and in his own mind, he has changed. He has changed from not spending before. Previously, he would, if he couldn't buy the player that he wanted, he wouldn't settle for second best. I think now he is settling for second best, and you can see it in terms of the way that this current squad is structured. So for the first time in many years, Arsenal have got every position covered. Now, do they have a world-class centre-forward? The answer is no. They don't have enough world-class players, and that is something that Arsene will come round to, but he will not spend over the odds still. His legacy will be the fact that he's built a winning team, given a lot of joy to a lot of people. There will never be another team like the Invincibles unless he has a second wind, which I can't see that happening to a man of 67. But he's also built the modern club in terms of the stadium and the training ground. But in terms of his own personal legacy, he will feel unfulfilled if he leaves Arsenal without another Premiership title or a Champions League title. But what he hasn't realised, and what only David Dean can tell him, is, Arsene, you've got to spend more money to do this. David Dean said, and this is his motto, every time I get up in the morning, and this was when he was obviously the vice chairman of Arsenal, before I look in the mirror to shave, I look at my forehead, and on the forehead, it says the message, get a winning team. And that's what drove him. Now, he could actually tell Arsene, we need so-and-so in terms of a position, but he would never, ever challenge Arsene. And this is still a weak point. If you look at the backup that Alex Ferguson had, the backup that Mourinho had, the backup that Conte has, the backup that Klopp has, and then you compare that to Arsene Wenger, well, he's operating with one hand behind his back. The problem is that when Arsene Wenger first came, he was a revolutionary. But other people saw that, copied his ideas, took it on, and actually found it much easier to delegate than he does. He finds it so difficult because his life is wrapped up in the training and the coaching of the players. And that's why there is nobody to challenge him and nobody for him to delegate in terms of people of substance. You might say that's very harsh on Steve Bould, but how much manoeuvring does Steve Bould have? What chance does he have to influence the way that the team plays? His qualities are obviously as a defensive organiser. Let me just contrast that very briefly with Terry Venables, who is a much maligned man these days. But Terry Venables is the best manager England never had for any long period of time. And this is the reason why. Because he was a good coach in his own right, but he looked at situations. For example, we coaches, we don't really understand goalkeeping. So he got in a specialist goalkeeping coach, someone he knew, Ray Clements, but someone who was good. So that was the first time England had a goalkeeping coach. Secondly, I know how to organise a team, but how much better would it be if I had Don Howe alongside me? So he got in Don Howe. And then thirdly, I'm a man in my mid-50s. These players are in their 20s and 30s. Who can they relate to? They might think I'm an old fart. So he got in Brian Robson. So you had Venables, Howe, Clements and Robson. This was a man who was confident in his own ability, so that he surrounded himself with men of quality. You saw that with Ferguson. That's why Ferguson dominated the Premier League era. He always refreshed his backup staff. One after another, you can name them. They were men of quality who challenged him and were allowed to coach. Ferguson delegated. The question is Wenger a better individual than Ferguson? I would say yes. But Ferguson recognised that and surrounded himself with other people that gave him an edge over Wenger.
Can you trace back the point at which Arsene started to be overly frugal with the finances at the club? Was it moving to the Emirates that made him have to be more frugal? And then, even though now we don't have to, he's still doing it? Because I vaguely remember when he first took over as manager, every season we'd be buying lots of decent players. And yeah, can you pinpoint the time roughly when he did it?
Well, you've got it. It was moving to the stadium. Arsenal did take out a very hefty loan. But even before that, they last made a loss in 2002. So even before they went to the Emirates, the ethos of the club was to prioritise profits over prizes. And Wenger fell very neatly into this objective because he said, I can make do with the young potential that we have. I promise you that we'll be successful. But success in his terms and success in the board's terms was in qualifying for the Champions League. I believe Arsene himself said the first trophy is to finish in fourth place. He should never have said that. That should never have been the limit of Arsenal's ambitions. Arsenal should always go for the title. And it took him a long time to change his philosophy. He felt that the ethos of the club should come first, and therefore he wasn't going to spend the sort of money that could actually help him acquire prizes. Latterly, Arsenal are so wealthy that they can afford to spend comparable money that will buy you world-class players. Nevertheless, he still finds it very difficult, and I would keep coming back to the same point. There's no one to tell him not to worry about the money, but just to get the player you want. And I just refer again to the Suarez example. It is believed, widely believed, and from some inside information, that Suarez would have been available at 50 million. Arsene was encouraged to spend 50 million and refused because he felt that he'd made a fair offer and that was it. I think now, when he makes a fair offer, Gazidis might be more proactive. And that is why you've seen, as you alluded to earlier, Danny Welbeck coming to the club, who might not have arrived if Arsene had been around rather than he was in Rome on the last day of that transfer window. And Sanchez and Ozil's money, well, I don't think that Arsene actually was the man who decided on the transfer fee. I think that was done elsewhere. They were determined to do something. They had to, in Ozil's case, after losing out on Suarez, had to do something dramatic. And it was a cloak and dagger operation that was carried out by Dick Law at Arsenal's wish, but probably with Ivan Gazidis rubber stamping it. And therefore, only 42.5 million was spent because the Arsenal board agreed on that rather than just the Arsenal manager.
Alex, I just want to change the subject a little bit. And one of the problems I've had in recent times is looking at the failure of our youth academy. I mean, over 20 years, we've produced Ashley Cole, Jack Wilshere, Kieran Gibbs under Liam Brady, which I think wasn't enough to help us with our squad strengths over the last 10 years or so. More recently, I mean, since we've appointed Andras Jonker from Wolfsburg, Iwobi's come through. There are a few more kids now, maybe earmarked for potential promotion. Would you agree that the academy is something that we need to keep working on over the next few years? Do you think it's on its way back now? What else can we do to keep these kids coming through? Because that's one thing that we have missed over the last decade.
You're quite right. And it's a case of better late than never. Liam Brady was one of the old school, a wonderful, wonderful player, but probably was in charge of the academy for too long without being challenged. The change has already borne fruit. Iwobi's come through. You could say that Bellerin is also a product of the academy, if you stretch a point. The future is there, but it took the threat of Arsenal of all clubs being downgraded from their premier status as an academy in order for change to happen. Change just takes far too long to happen in Arsenal. So other people have a head start. Arsenal will come good, but it will take time. And it shouldn't have taken so long to get the right man into the academy. Similarly, in terms of the number of injuries. The number of injuries, people are still pointing out that Arsenal have more injuries than most. It's not true. Since Shane Forsyth came and the pre-season training and the actual way of training being carried out, Arsenal's injury rate has fallen dramatically. It's almost halved in the last 2 years. The question that arises is, why did it take so long? And I go back, and I'm sorry if I'm sounding like someone who is repeating the old argument. It took so long because no one challenged Arsene, and because the ambitions of the club can be summarized by Stan Kroenke saying, well, if you want to win titles, you wouldn't get into this game in the first place. But now, of course, the game has changed with the huge amount of broadcast money. And people forget that broadcast money goes straight to the bottom line. Someone decides your rights are worth £100 million. That's £100 million worth of profit. So even Arsenal now have more money than they know what to do with. If only they prioritise their ambition as to say, if we want to have the optimum business, we've got to have the optimum team. The optimum team means buying more world-class players, winning titles, winning the Champions League, winning the Premier League, and therefore we would be set for the future. And we can develop the academy in the way that we wouldn't be pushed to at the moment, because we're now trying to catch up from the years, the fallow years. And it really is a condemnation when you mention the people who've come through after 10 years of the millions that were invested in the academy.
Thanks for that, Alex. It's David again. Along the same lines, or it leads into another question, the importance of the academy setup is in order to produce players so that you don't have to buy so many in an inflated market. But it's not only player values that are inflated at the moment now. We're in a situation where Alexis Sanchez and Mesut Ozil are in urgent need of renewing their contracts from a supporter's point of view. There's talk that they're both looking for something like double what they're on at the moment. And if you're going to attract and keep the world-class players in the way that you describe, the club is going to have to go some way towards that. Everybody knows that the television money's coming in. The players want their cut the same as everybody else. Is your view that we're growing the commercial side of the club, though, quickly enough to sustain additional world-class players until the academy is fixed?
David, we don't need to. In 2010, because of player sales and because of property sales, Arsenal were the biggest club in the world, along with Real Madrid. Deloitte, who do the analysis of the standing, you know, of clubs in terms of their turnover, they ignored the property income. But in 2010, Arsenal were, along with Real Madrid, the biggest club in the world. So the money is there. It's just a question of having the will to spend it. And I'm afraid, even if you look at the last transfer window, Arsenal spending £90 million, their key and closest rival spending well over 100, it's a gap that there shouldn't be. And I think it will always be this way, so long as Arsenal doesn't have a really strong backup team who will challenge him, both in terms of finding players and then also tactically, because we've got to look at tactics. I mean, could you have imagined what happened at Chelsea? They began the season playing in a certain way. The coach thought that it needed to change. There was a dramatic change, and that has been transformed in the way that the team have played. It may be early days yet, it may be premature, but Arsene does not have this tactical acumen, and that's what you need now. You need courage, you need tactical acumen, you need humility in order to admit that you might be wrong. And whilst you might be a genius, which he is, and be right 8 times out of 10, the odd occasion that you're wrong, somebody else might be right, and two heads in this instance would be better than one. So money is the answer, I'm afraid. More world-class players, and be prepared to pay the obscene wages, because that's what they are. They are obscene when you don't need to pay, though, or I'm afraid that you probably do now, so I'm contradicting myself. The fact is that the train has already left the station. You can't turn the clock back. You can't drop the wage levels what they are. But the television money should not allow you to say, right, well, we've got to pay the players this obscene amount of money, therefore we'll charge these exceptionally high prices to the fans, knowing that fans are different from customers. There has to be a happy medium. You've got to pay the players what they market actually determines, but you've got the money from television. Arsenal were the first club to get over £100 million domestically last year. Next year, if they finish second in the same position, they'll get £150 million. And the Champions League money is going up. So there's really no excuse not to speculate, to accumulate, if the ambition is to win titles.
Excellent stuff, Alex. I've got a couple of questions to you now just to wrap things up. One, the first one's slightly tongue-in-cheek. The second one's actually rather more serious. But chapter 22 of your book, Time for Change, you have a little, quite an amusing section on Dennis Roach. He was the football agent in the 80s. He sent a lot of players from England overseas. He had a good relationship with Arsene Wenger, and you say in the book that Arsene Wenger would come over for his weekly or monthly fix of English football because he just loved the game, and especially in England. And one of his first ports of call, believe it or not, was Tottenham Hotspur. Now, you also say that Arsene Wenger also had a good relationship with the chairman of Tottenham at that time, Irving Scholar. I seem to think that you're suggesting that if things hadn't gone the way it had gone, that Arsene could have ended up at Tottenham. Is that what you're suggesting, or are you hinting? I found it quite funny.
That's absolutely what I'm suggesting. I knew Arsene before David Dean. I first met Arsene in 1985. In 1985, there was a very close relationship with Tottenham. They played each other during the French winter break. They even played for a particular trophy. Dennis Roach, who was Tottenham's key agent, took over Hoddle. And subsequently Mark Hatley. So he had a very good relationship with Arsene Wenger. Roach was a key motivator and a key organizer, and he brought Wenger over to England. He took him first to White Hart Lane. I met Arsene in the White Hart Lane boardroom, and I said, are you aware of the Tottenham history? This is a rubbish Tottenham team, because it was. You know, the Tottenham team was the Tottenham history really was the double side. Wenger wasn't too aware of the Tottenham history in that sense. He wasn't aware of the fact that Arsenal were successful but perhaps boring under George Graham. George Graham once said to me, I love 1-0 victories. That's what the ethos was. What was important, of course, in the bottom line, is winning trophies. So you had a Tottenham team who were not playing to their philosophy. You had an Arsenal side who were actually winning trophies. But Wenger's philosophy of football was in the line with the Tottenham tradition. And if Irving Scholar, who was the most cosmopolitan and forward-looking of chairmen at the time, had not been obsessed by Terry Venables, then come 1987, when he was looking for a change of manager, he could have gone for Arsene Wenger.
And that's really interesting. I'd never really thought about that. Three times Terry Venables agreed to be Arsenal manager, and all three times it fell through. I know once it fell through because he wasn't going to take it because they hadn't told Don Howe that he was going, and so he said, well, as you haven't done that, I'm not doing it because that's not gentlemanly. Is it true that three times he agreed to be our manager?
No, it's twice he was offered the job, and twice he turned it down, and once, you're absolutely right, it was because of the way that he thought that his friend Don Howe was being treated. The first time was when he'd given his word to the Crystal Palace chairman, and he felt that he wasn't ready for such a big club as Arsenal. So he was twice offered the Arsenal job, twice turned it down for different reasons.
Excellent, excellent. we're going to wrap things up with one final question. It's actually quite a very important question for most Arsenal fans, if not all Arsenal fans. And I'm going to just quote you from your book, Alex, if I may. In an interview, David Dean in 2014, he was quoted as saying, "He will not be a difficult act to follow, who will be an impossible act to follow. I wish the next manager, whoever he may be, and whenever he comes in, takes the club into the Champions League successively for the next 20 years. And I'll tell you two things. One, he won't be able to do it. And two, he won't be there for 20 years. There will be a time in the future, whether people like it or not, Arsene Wenger will not be at Arsenal Football Club. He will retire at some point, whether it's next year, 2 years, 10, 15 years' time. How difficult will the transition be from the years of Arsene Wenger to a completely new manager? What's your opinion on that?
It will be exceptionally difficult because the Arsenal board do not have sufficient football men really calling the shots. They desperately need someone of David Dean's ability. His contact book is second to none. He's still valued, although this is, you know, a dubious valuation by the big wigs at FIFA and UEFA. So he has a contact book and he has a love of the club. And of course, he has the experience along with Arsene of getting most of the invincibles. There's nobody in the club with that sort of culture. And it's sadly missing. So it will be a very, very difficult period, which is one reason why, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And in the words of the board, it ain't broke because we're still qualifying for the Champions League. Therefore, if Arsene wants to stay, he'll stay. He will stay.
What you're suggesting, and perhaps I'm suggesting as well at the same time, is that at some point it will change. It has to change because, you know, life doesn't go on forever and ever. And what you're suggesting is that before that even happens, that changes would need to be done at board level to bring more footballing people in before we can actually make that transition. Is that right?
Or the board have to change their mindset and actually say, perhaps we need a football director, someone who can advise the manager if he is intending to stay. Or perhaps we need someone who can take over from him, who we can groom. I mean, there is no number two of substance there because Arsene still really controls everything really on the playing side and a lot of things that are not on the playing side. So changes have to take place. We have to have people on the board who change their culture or bring people in. You see, for example, Ken Fryer has been a wonderful servant for the club, but he's an octogenarian. He should have been replaced many years ago and given an honorary status and, of course, kept in the loop in terms of his counsel. But where is a Ken Fryer of maybe 50 or even 60 years of age? They're not there on the Arsenal board. And where is the number two on the playing side? Pat Rice was there for many years, but how much did he really contribute? Steve Bould knows how to organise a defence, but is he given the same sort of room to manoeuvre as Terry Venables gave Don Howe? So change has to happen all the way through the club. The best thing that could happen, and here's an idealistic situation that won't happen, is that David Dean comes back, is on the board, helps his friend to continue. Arsene spend a lot more money and they win titles. So that could happen, but it won't happen. And if you're not going to bring Dean back, then you've got to find another David Dean, although you won't, because nobody gave such commitment and such love to the club. And it's a great shame that we don't see that in terms of the board, in terms of the ability and the stature and the knowledge of the culture of the game and Arsenal in particular.
Absolutely fascinating chat with Alex there. Alex, what's the future for you? What's your plans for the next couple of years? Have you got more books in the pipeline? I know you're a speaker at dinners. What are your plans over the next 18 months, 2 years?
Well, I wish that was true. Unfortunately, you get to a certain age and you're regarded as yesterday's man. So the consultancy has dried up. The speaking engagements are fewer and further between. The books, well, it goes in inverse proportion to the amount of effort you put in and the rewards that you get. So I don't really know. I get a lot of satisfaction of having worked with a number of clubs and following them. You might say that I'm not a fan like yourself because although I like Arsenal, I don't really dislike Tottenham. And the clubs who have treated me better are the ones, the further you go north, the smaller the clubs in the Premier League, the nicer they are. So I've been treated better in the north than I have in London. And I'm just looking, I'm now, you know, an outsider looking in rather than someone who is inside, who might have in some small way affected events in the past. So I just look at it and at best, no, I would say at worst, I'm a friendly critic. And that's what will happen in the future. Could I just say about the book, if any of the listeners want it, there's a special price if they go through to www.visionsp.co.uk. Put in the code of AW, then they'll get it for £6 as opposed to £8.99.
Put it on the website as well tonight via Danny. But I'd just like to say that although you are being treated well up north, you'll always be treated well on this podcast, and you're always welcome to come back to talk about your books or just to talk about football in general. It's always great to have you on here. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I did. I hope I didn't sound too negative. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to sound positive, entirely positive, if you believe certain facts could be adjusted so easily. So forgive me if I sounded too negative, but I really would like Arsene to go out in a blaze of glory with a Champions League trophy. And if he can't have that, at least a Premier League trophy. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for the testing questions. And I hope you got some at least insightful answers.
Thanks very much, Alex. And Danny and Dave, thank you very much as well for coming on tonight. I think this is a really good listen tonight. And hopefully our listeners over the next few days will enjoy what's been said tonight.
I enjoyed every minute of it as well. Thank you very much, Alex, for coming on.
Raj, David, Danny, thank you so much, the three of you, for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Cheers, Alex. I could listen to you talk for hours.
That's very kind.
And this is the Reverend Raj signing off from a very special book review on the ABW podcast. See you soon. Goodbye. Listen, all you people.